Ready?
Yeah.
Okay. Wait, turn on the microphone, give me a little power here. Let's see. First of all, let's begin that today is October 3rd, 2011. It is Monday morning. It is the day after Tzom Gedalia, second day of Slicha, if I recall what we said a number of hours ago. I look around my minyan, the 5:30 minyan, I have to tell you that it's more than half Yeshiva University graduates. As a matter of fact, I would say almost half the minyan on Yeshiva University Musmachim. So, Baruch Hashem. I just want to relate I received a beautiful email from a Talmud of mine who I met last Pesach, Mr. Stuart Haber of Manchester. And I just want to tell you, we tried emailing you back, and the secretary tells me did not go through to the United Kingdom email address. But I want to thank you, Stuart, for your very kind words about my lectures. And what you said moved me greatly, that I think you have gone up a step beyond Torah derech Eretz and simply teach a version of Torah im Seichel, if I may be so bold. So I thank you very much. That's a wonderful compliment. I also want to mention that I received correspondence on my new book from a young man in Beit Shemesh, Avi Spiegelman, whose father was my classmate. And he makes what may be a correction, which is very interesting. When I was in Vilna in 1989, the locals, of course, gave us a tour and explained everything. And I mentioned in my book that when they destroyed the Jewish cemetery, it was plowed over, a sports stadium was constructed, and he quotes from my book, the Jewish community was allowed to reinter the remains of the Vilna Gaon and of Chaim Eisner and their immediate families in the new Jewish cemetery. I just want to mention that he tells me that Professor Lyman of Yeshiva University did research, and he claims, and if he claims, it's probably correct, that the Gaon and Reb Chaim Eisner were reburied there, but from two different old Jewish cemeteries. So that to me is news, because I was told they were both reburied from the Schlippishtuk cemetery, and here I stand corrected if it is so, although really if you read the book, it may or may not be a mistake. It may be that I'm simply mentioned that they were reinterred. But anyway, I appreciate that insight. Now, last week, of course, we touched upon a tremendous problem in the Mizrahi world. The minute you get involved in culture, you have to ask the question, whose culture, what type of culture? And Lo Darki Darkechem, Barak claims he's a Zionist, Golda Meir claims she's a Zionist, Ben-Gurion claims he was a Zionist, Shimon Peres claims he's a Zionist. And I don't have to tell you the great difference between my Zionism and the Zionism of Shimon Peres. And of course, when it comes to Chinuch, how are you machaneh? Is the State of Israel just a refuge for Jews? Save our lives, run away from Hitler, run away from the Nazis, run away from persecution, run away from pogroms? Or is the State of Israel a fulfillment of Eretz Yisrael and Kedushat Eretz Yisrael and all the mitzvot that go with living in the State of Israel? And the other day, in my building, we have wonderful people living in, it's a very beautiful address, Rehov Rav Chaim Berlin, 18. And the years have moved on. We had so many Rabbanim Gedoli Yisrael living there. Unfortunately, they're all gone already. Zichronim Levracha. We have a younger generation today. So among the younger generation is a young lady, a mother of five sons from Australia, married to a young man, a graduate of Alon Shvut and a PhD, works in research from London. And she's a nurse. And she was coming back from the hospital, going to the hospital. I met her on Yontif, and she was very depressed. And she says, it's not pleasant to work. The patients are yelling at you. People are yelling at you. You know, there's not enough help in the hospital. So I told her, But remember, what you're doing is a tremendous mitzvah, two mitzvot involved. One mitzvah is, of course, Gemilat Chesed, a nurse. I don't have to tell you, Rofa Cholim, Gemilat Chesed, helping people who can't help themselves. And secondly, you're involved in mitzvah Yishuv Haaretz. Whatever you do in Israel has an added mitzvah, so much so that the Chatam Sofer raised the question in his commentary on Sukkah, on the sugya there, in Osek B'mitzvah, Patim in a Sukkah, with the Chatan V'Kala, and who's Kayv and Sukkah, who's not. And the Chatan Sofer says, if you live in Israel, how do you have time to daven? How do you stop building the land, working the land, farming the land, constructing, doing everything that enhances mitzvah Yishuv Haaretz? And of course, this is one type of Zionism. Believe me, Shimon Peres never thought of this type of Zionism. So the minute you get involved with that question, what do you do? And we have struggled with that question for 110 years now. I think it's the single greatest issue that's on the agenda. And you have to bear in mind, I didn't say this last week, but I want to make this clear, that on as much as you have on the one end of the spectrum, Chovevei Torah thinking, pluralism, everyone is Jewish, everyone is accurate, people have free choice. On the other end of the spectrum, let's say you'll say you have Satmar. But as much as you have Satmar, even Satmar doesn't give up on their fellow Jew. They also understand that Jews are Jews are Jews. And amongst Satmar, you'll meet very fine individuals, people who are involved in outreach, people who can explain Torah Hashem Tamima very coherently. And we face this dilemma. How do you balance out the two, reaching out to everyone and simultaneously retaining our dignity as Torah Jews? And this issue does not go away. We face the issue in Germany. We face the issue in the United States. 1956, I always say that's the red letter date when right-wing Torah in America became extremely powerful and went onto the map. And that issue haunts us. I can tell you when the, I've said this over the years, I repeat it again because it's privileged conversation. When the United Synagogue Council came to an end in I believe it was 1996, so it was a tremendous simcha. I was at the OU convention. I was a guest speaker. And the Rabbi Pinchas Stopler, who then was a big shot in the OU, got up, and it was Friday night in front of about 800, 900 people. He made a shechiyanu, b'shemu malchut, that we live to see the day that the synagogue council ended. So Chief Rabbi Lau was davening right next to me. So I said to the chief rabbi, zot bracha levatava. If you do make a blessing, the blessing should have been Baruch Atova HaMeitiv, because it's not just good for Pinchas Stopler, for all the Jews. And if you can't make a Tova HaMeitiv, then you can't make a bracha at all. You're following, if it's bad news, what are you making a bracha? So that summer, Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, was, and by the way, in the book of Rabbi Sabato, interviewing Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, which I'm going to quote in my next shir in Halacha, Be'ezrat Hashem. Whenever that falls, you'll see what I'll be quoting from it, I'll talk about the book at a future date, but not yet. It's a very fascinating volume. So you see Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein's awe for Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik. Mamish awe. Mamish awe. So I was very close to Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. My relationship with Rav Aaron goes back to 1960, when he took the Rav Shir and the Rav Basil, and then he came to teach in YU, and we taught on the same floor. And we were very close. Whatever the reasons were, Rav Aaron was a Ziskite of a human being, and he was, just as the Rav was unapproachable, and when you approached the Rav, you felt you couldn't go near him. It took a long time to learn how to pierce the umbilical cord around the Rav, the umbilical cord that attached him to Reb Chaim, to Bris, to Volozhin. And you know, an American kid, you had to learn how to pierce. I learned how, but it took a number of years. But Rav Aaron was very approachable and very very just a zis a human being, a sweetness of a human being. So we're walking in the old city, or Reb Aaron already was in a wheelchair, and his son Reb Yosef was wheeling him, and I say to Reb Aaron, it's not that I needed chutzpah because you could talk with him. I say to Reb Aaron, Rebbe, why are we so happy that the synagogue council ended? After all, the Rav was in favor, and the Rav fought such a battle, you know, to stand against all the other Russian yeshiva, and Mifrein Zich, and we're happy. So Reb Aaron said to me, you're absolutely right, but it's a different synagogue council today. My brother would have been opposed. I say, what do you mean? And you see, by 96 already, the homosexual issue, the issue, who is a Jew, the Reform movement already declared that if your father is Jewish, you're Jewish. It doesn't matter what the mother is, patrilineal. It doesn't have to be, what's the other word, matriarchal, I think. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but it's patrilineal. And he said, my brother would no longer be in favor of a synagogue council. Well, the Rav was not there to ask. You understand what I'm saying, Moshe? I couldn't argue with Reb Aaron. It's an interesting thought. On the other hand, this issue still does not go away because people will look at Rakefid. He came out against Chovevei Torah. He's a fanatic. He came out against the Shira Hadasha. You heard my talk in public at the Great Synagogue. All right, I'm not such a big fanatic anymore, because at Sohar and Rabbi Lichtenstein came out with the same opinion, except I said it 2 years ago. I was ahead of the crowd. but we struggle. We struggle with this viewpoint. And what do you do if you have someone who is totally observant, total Shomer Mitzvah, but he believes in historical development? In other words, he'll tell you, Frankel's concept of Mishnah is my concept. Acharam was not entirely wrong. You follow me? What do you do with a person like that? Do you declare him chutz l'tchum? And I can give you, I just got the question, how should we view Marcus Jastrow? No. Everyone in the room here uses the Jastrow Dictionary. I use it, you use it, we grew up with it. I mean, before ArtScroll, and even today with ArtScroll, you need the Jastrow Dictionary at times. No, how do you view it? How do you view him? He was, he allowed certain innovations in his temple in Philadelphia. On the other hand, or in Baltimore, I think Jastrow, no, he was in Philadelphia. Zold was in Baltimore. Henrietta Zold's father, Benjamin Zold, was in Baltimore. So he allowed certain innovations, but how do you view it? On the other hand, he was bitter against the Reform and one of the founders of JTS, which was founded as an Orthodox institution. If you recall my lectures, I went through the charter and everything. So you see, how do you view? You want to push him away? You know, the Rav, who was very open-minded, so the Rav used to say that in Jerusalem he heard, again, you have to understand this, Daniel, the Chochmat Yisrael people. Chaim, I don't know if you recognize what I'm saying, Chochmat Yisrael, it's not for now, but Chochmat Yisrael, it's a different approach. Read the Rakefid's book. The new book has a whole chapter on Bernard Revel. And he's a very naughty man, Rakefid, because he reproduces a letter that Dr. Belton told him, what was it, 50, 60 years ago, 50 years ago. Don't produce that letter. Lose it in the text. Read Revel and compare it with Washington. You follow me? And you'll see in Revel, Rothkopf was a good boy. He lost the letter in the text. In Washington, Rakefid was a bad boy. And he didn't listen to Rabbi Belkin, and he reproduces Rabbi Belkin's letter to Rabbi Revel, which is absolutely classic. You can't understand what Bernard Revel Graduate School is about, or should be about, or what Bar Ilan should be about, without Rabbi Belkin's letter to Rabbi Revel. So the Rav used to tell us that in Yerushalayim, they're the old-time Chachmat Yisrael people, and they open an umbrella before Shabbos, and there's an Erev, and they go with an umbrella when it's raining on Shabbos. No, you're going to criticize them. You know, what's wrong? Just think for a minute. Why can't you open an umbrella? Binyan arai. It's not a binyan. It's not a binyan kavua. It's a nari, the rabbanon. No, you open it before Shabbos. Rain is bikuach nefesh. You know the story with Mordechai Kaplan, which people swear is true. Again, I'm only repeating. I heard it anecdotally. You follow me, Moshe Raps? I'm wrapping it out. It's an anecdote, but I heard it. I heard it. That Mordechai Kaplan, this I can tell you, I knew Mordechai Kaplan, I spoke with him in learning, he was trying to, he shows me his fringes, he thinks I didn't know who he was, I gave him a lift, he lived around the corner from the old BMT, it was a riot, you know, I was a young kid, I guess he took me for an Amoritz and ignoramus, I knew who he was, I knew his whole shita, but I wasn't going to spit in his face, all right, I'm giving the man a lift, it was from a house of mourning. And he shows me his fringes, you know. I wanted to say to him, the difference between your fringes and my tzitzit is I'm wearing my tzitzit because it's Tavah Hashem. And you're wearing your fringes because it's a Jewish civilization. So you should know. Well, you know what I'm talking about? Mordechai Kaplan, Judaism as a civilization. Are you familiar with it, Chaim? You're familiar with it? So are you a good Jew or not? May I open up the Wikipedia? There's an entry there on Rakefet. They quote him saying, if you don't know, Rakefet said this, if you don't know the Vayoam Moshe by heart, you can't be a good Zionist. If you don't know Judaism as a civilization by heart, you can't be a real Torah Jew. You follow me? You have to understand what we're talking about. So Mordechai Kaplan used to wear two handkerchiefs tied together around his neck on Shabbos. You follow? So they said to him, Professor Kaplan, you're so medatek in mitzvahs that you don't carry, you know, he didn't believe in God, why should he? He says, my father went like this in Shabbos. This is the Jewish civilization. So one time it was raining, and there's Mordechai Kaplan with an umbrella on the Upper West Side where he lived. So they said to him, Professor Kaplan, here you wear two handkerchiefs around your neck, and here you're carrying an umbrella on Shabbos? And he said, for a civilization, you don't get sick. You follow? All right, that's a Meir Dikvot that's attributed to Mordechai Kaplan. But that shows you the dilemma we're caught up with. So I don't want to dismiss this question lightly. And I don't want to leave you with the feeling that I'm going to maledict anyone who doesn't agree with Mizrahi. But Mizrahi has to be respected. This was the point of view they took. It's not always easy to give a black and white answer. I understand that students appreciate black and white answers. Not always, Charlie, can you give a black and white answer? But we struggle with this principle. And I struggle until today. At times, I wish I had the Rav, you know, I could talk with him. Rebbe, what should I do? But all right, life moves on and you have to take responsibility. And whenever I get a question on this topic, I always think, what would Rebbe say? So I told you last week what my guidelines are. I don't say, thank you, Matan. I don't say, leave a chair for David. He should be here shortly. Near you. And I don't say I've solved the problem, but at least I struggle with it in what I hope is an intelligent way. On the other hand, with something like Limud, I personally can't participate. I can't bring myself. I may be wrong. Rabbi Lamb has a different viewpoint. I greatly respect Rabbi Lamb. I can understand this viewpoint, but I personally, it bothers me that on one door it says Rakefet is teaching, the door next door is a conservative rabbi. The door down there is a woman who's a humanist, doesn't even believe in God. She's a lesbian, and she's a reform rabbi, and we're all equal, and you take your choice. I don't know. On the other hand, I know in the army that, and this is not a laughing matter, that when I finished a shayur in the army, they would surge forth, the sfadim, kiss your fingers, and they were in tears. And I met people, my wife never believed me until it happened in front of her eyes, that we're walking on Rehov Yaffa and an army car stops and a guy drives. I remember the name until today. We're talking something that happened more than 30 years ago. Avram Kadosh jumps out and he hugs me and he tells my wife, Baglal Balecha, Nishoma Mitzvah Tayom, Nishoma Shabbat Ligamrei. And I once was in Machne Yehuda, and a big truck is pulling up, delivering cans of beer and whatnot. And the driver jumps out. He heard me. He thanked me. He kissed me. And I realized that where did they go to school? Even if they went to Mamlachti Dati schools at that time, the level was so low. Who were the teachers? This was a real problem in Israel. It still may be a problem in what we call Second Israel and Third Israel. And here in the army, you had top lecturers. Our division of the rabbinate, the Havai Dat, and it, all that mattered is that you had to be a good marzah. Matzeh mitzvian, zeh koma shehevi'u b'cheshbon. And our lecturers ranged all the way from Merkaz HaRav to Panovich, all doing their army service in the rabbinate. And here you had these people who never heard a good shiur before. So I want to tell you, I don't want to dismiss Rabbi Lamb's opinion. Maybe he's right that people who would choose to come into room 103 and hear the Orthodox rabbi will hear something they never heard before. It's a real, live, ongoing problem. We live with it. I have my point of view. There are other points of view, some to the right of me, some to the left of me. I respect them all. We struggle. Okay. Now, let me come back to something that I said so many times, that the name of the Rabban becomes very, very important. Ger v'toshev anachim machem. Avram Avinu says to Chitai, to his people, a Jew has a dual identity. On one hand, Nisanel, do I have you? No, Nisanel Fishman.
Moshe.
One second, that's not you, one second. Moshe Lester. Okay. So Nisanel Fishman is not here. Everyone else, I think I know their names. Okay, and Chaim, thank you for, so you see we are related.
Yeah, we are.
That's called Yiddish Machetenschlaf. That's the word for it. We are related. Okay, Moshe, a Jew has a dual identity. We're Jews, we're different. We're different than the rest of the world. On the other hand, we're human beings, we're part of the world. If a cure for cancer is discovered today, we're going to dance with joy like every other civilized person. You follow me? We live in a dual world. On a higher level, we're affected by the events going on. We don't live in a vacuum, and we all understand that. Now, let's talk about Zionism. Zionism, fine, a beautiful idea, a wonderful idea, a clever idea. A messianic idea, perhaps. You know, much has been written that Zionism is a result of our belief in Mashiach Tzidkenu, and it's just translating the belief into a Western terminology or secular terminology, call it what you wish. Gentlemen, who gives a hoot? People are busy. I would tell Yitzchak, ask your neighbor, your father, Michael Miller, to go back to Lower Merion Synagogue, where you come from, where I was once the second rabbi. Okay? Good people today. Major center of Torah, the major center in Pennsylvania. Right or wrong? No one equals Lower Merion. Nothing in Harrisburg, nothing in Philadelphia, Lower Merion. Go back and preach to them. Ladies and gentlemen, you believe in the Torah, Lech Lecha Miyatzchem, Ladechem Bebeit Aveicha. How many people are going to listen? They're going to laugh at your father. People are busy. People are caught up. Okay, 10%. What did I say at the public lecture at the Great Synagogue? America gives its Trumot and Maisrit to Medina Yisrael. All right, 10% coming Aliyah. Halavai, 10%. I just spent 5 weeks in Borough Park. I have a lot of Talmidim in Borough Park, a lot of friends in Borough Park, wonderful people in Borough Park. Now, start talking Aliyah. They'll laugh at you. Fine, good, beautiful. Person has to make a living, he's caught up, his wife is not going to move away. She loves Pomegranate, and she loves ShopRite, she loves all the shopping she has, she loves 13th Avenue. What are you, ma pitom, you're going to move her away to a strange country. All right. Zionism made no inroad whatsoever. It got started 1897, okay, Zionist Congress. It affected 1,000 Jews, 10,000 Jews. I'll give a liberal estimation, Morty, 20,000 Jews. How many Jews were there in the world then? 15, 16 million. Who gave a hoot? Tell me, what made Golda Meir a Zionist? How many of you read her autobiography? The pogroms in Kishinev. She was there yet. She saw it. She felt it. World War I came along. The Jew was caught on the battlefield. What are we talking about, World War I? Were you there? Look at the map. Germany, Poland, Lithuania, White Russia, Ukraine. The Germans fighting the Russians. Who's caught in the middle? The Jew. Jewish suffering was terrible. And by the end of World War I, you had recognition the only solution for the Jew is his homeland to normalize, to be a normal people. The Balfour Declaration, Palestine, Eretz Israel. Zionism became popular. And instead of 10, 20,000 Zionists, you now have hundreds and hundreds of thousands. Real Zionists going, supporting, educating. And of course, if the general Zionist movement expanded, Mizrahi caught on. And here I want to come to Divrei Torah that I developed, if you recall, about 2 years ago when I introduced, or a year and a half ago, when I introduced the Besamim Rosh. Remember in the Sunday class I spent a year on the literary forgery by Reb Shaul Berlin, the Besamim Rosh. And if you recall, I quoted to you from the Zohar, I gave you the exact sources. Hakol talui b'mazel afilu sefer Torah shebehecha. You're going to find out as you grow older, and it's unfortunate. Everything in life depends upon mazel. Even the Sefer Torah in the Aron Kodesh. You know what that means. I explained it. That if you go to an Aron Kodesh and there tends to free Torah, the one you choose to read has mazel. And it's really unfair, you understand, because in school you do well, you're rewarded. You do poorly, you're punished. But life is not like that. Life, you mamish need mazel. My wife's grandmother, who I yet knew so well, these are Jews that came to America in the 1870s and remained from. My wife's grandmother's mother is buried in America. So she couldn't speak English, but the only word she knew in English is Olzain Lucky. Olzain Lucky is loosely translated, should have mazel. Now, what does mazel mean? So I've often said, I can develop this with the Gemaras, but it's not important now. What's important is the idea. In life, there are three factors. The right person in the right place at the right time. If that happens to you, you have mazel. If it doesn't happen to you, it can be very frustrating, aggravating, and at times can be tragic. And I've seen time and again in life, the right person, but he's never in the right place at the right time. And I've seen idiots, schlemazels, phonies, panhandlers, gamblers, pimps, moral decrepitant people, but they're in the right place at the right time. And I don't want to give examples, but you all understand what I'm saying. It's just a question of masi, nesanel, right? Okay, we got you now. Question of masi. One individual turns out to be the right person in the right place at the right time. By the way, coming back, if you talk about the Rav, it's a perfect example. 1935, Moriah Rebbe travels to Israel, and Nesanel, he's fishing for a job here. He's not at home in America yet. He's a fishman. And what does he stand for? The chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. Could you imagine had they elected him? Tova Lichtenstein raises the issue in her talk at Van Leer, which was published by Hebrew University recently. I've told Tova, had your father been elected chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, he would have gone on to become another Rav Kook, Alat Mata Kodesh. The man would have developed totally differently than he developed in Boston and New York. But he was in the wrong place at the wrong time. Or the right place at the wrong time. You follow? Wasn't elected. 1959, when they pleaded with him, and I was his Talmud, and I saw the letter from Rav Reuven Katz, showed it to us. Showed us his answer to Rav Reuven Katz, which I don't, you know, the answer was double talk. The answer is what I'm telling you now. It's very simple. He was the right man, but it was the wrong time already. He was Americanized, he was older, he had found his niche in life, his place. He was sick already, life was not that kind to him. He was no longer the strength that he had in 35. There's a big difference between 35 to 1960, okay? That's a perfect example, Hakol Taloi B'Mazel. And from my point of view, as I've said many times, thank God that the Israelis are a bunch of morons. You've heard me say that. If they elected him in 1935, chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, I wouldn't be sitting here. Yitzhak wouldn't be sitting here. Be a different ballpark altogether. We had mazel with one bus fare, the 36 bus in the Bronx. I told you, we got on at Washington Avenue. Got off 18, 20 minutes later, Amsterdam Avenue, walked 5 blocks, and there we were, opened the door to room 102, and there the little jerk like myself sitting, the rubber sitting here, and I'm sitting here. You don't believe me? I have a picture in my office. Pictures don't lie. There I am, right here. Rebbe could not get out without my standing up, because it was very crowded, you understand? Like I told you Tuesday night, the seats around him, you fought for those seats. Once you gained it, you did not let anyone take it away from you. Moshe, all this leads up to the most famous name in the history of the Mizrahi, Rav Meir Berlin, known to you as Rav Meir Bar Ilan. Michael, his years 1880 to 1949. Now, first of all, you have to understand the name Berlin. He was the son of the Netziv. I need not tell you that being the son of the Netziv adds to your prestige. This is the son of the Netziv, Reb Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin. What's fascinating about the Netziv, he married twice. His first wife died. Zivik Sheni, he was much older, he married his niece. His niece happened to be the daughter of the Aruch HaShulchan. You can correct me if I'm wrong. The Netziv sister was married to Rabbi Chiel Michal Epstein, the Aruch HaShulchan. Zivik Sheni Labriyot, he married the daughter of the Aruch HaShulchan, the sister of the Torah Tamima. She married her uncle, who was something like 40 plus years older, and she made a condition with him that she wants to have children, and I believe I know, when he was over 70, he fathered Reb Meir Berlin, so that he had two very famous sons, Reb Chaim Berlin, and Reb Meir Berlin. There were 48 years between them. And Michael, that is only possible from two wives. Okay? 48 years. So Reb Meir Berlin, who barely knew the glory of the Lashon, but he already was being raised at a time when Zionism was on the map, and it sieved the Chibat Zion, the Chovev Bein Torah, the nascent religious Zionist movement. He already was deeply affected, deeply impressed. Now, Reb Meir Berlin was much broader. He already was not only the son of the Netziv, but he was into modern Hebrew. He was widely read literature. He was into Agada. He was a public speaker. He was a much broader personality. And in 1913, he emigrates to the greatest city outside the state of Israel, New York. And following World War I, America is now the leader of the Jewish people. This is America, Daniel, what they did for Hatzalah work. Have you studied the period, the Central Relief, the People's Relief, the Joint Distribution Committee? What America did, it took the leadership. Tens of millions of dollars raised, distributed. It's now the focal point. It's now the center. And there is Reb Meir Berlin functioning out of what was then the heart of Jewish existence. Most interesting for us, sitting in this institution that is under the aegis of Yeshiva University. 1917, he organizes the Beit Medrash L'Rabbanim in Manhattan. Well, what does that mean?
In 1913, he came to America?
In 1917, he organized, yeah, 1913, he comes to America, he's a greenhorn, he acclimates. He was an activist for the Mizrahi. We'll come. I just want to tell you about why you. Then we're going to come to the Mizrahi. He was an activist, a propagandist, an organization, an office, a newspaper, articles, a polemicist, a speaker, an orator. But he realized that you need teachers, and you need teachers who are committed to the Mizrahi ideal. And you're fighting a tremendous battle in America. At this point, there are endless Talmud Torah. There are very few day schools. Outside of New York, there are no day schools whatsoever, basically. And you need teachers. And he organizes the Teachers Institute, Beit Medrash L'Rabbanim, to train teachers. L'morim, excuse me. Beit Medrash L'morim, to train teachers. Thank you. And doesn't really succeed. It struggles because he's not a pedagogue. He's not an administrator. He's busy out there traveling. He's busy out there preaching. He's busy out there teaching about Mizrahi. And the Beis Medrash L'morim struggles. At this point, Yeshivas Reb Tzvi Elchanan is starting to expand. January 1916, the yeshiva opens a high school, Talmudical Academy. You look at me today, Nisanel is looking, what's the big deal? A high school for yeshiva boys? There are a million of them around today. This was the first one in the United States. It was unheard of. And you don't know what battles were fought till it was organized. The board of directors of the yeshiva were totally opposed when the students went on strike. Have you read Gil Klapman's doctorate? Nathaniel, have you fished it out of the library?
Not
yet. Read it. Learn about the institution. Did you go to Yeshiva College? And they let you graduate without knowing about the history of the institution?
I don't know what they were thinking.
Oh, my gosh. They must have been asleep on the job. The Shin Gimel was asleep. That's what was going on. Take my word for it. So the board of directors said, what, you want a high school? Over our dead bodies. We went to Yeshiva in Gilead in Europe. We didn't have to know any high schools. Good genug for us. Good enough. We made a lot of money in real estate. I have a big store in Canal Street. You're going to waste time. I should give money that you should learn in high school? Forbidden. 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 Big battles. Ephraim, big battles were fought. Ah, and then finally, the rabbis, Rabbi Leventhal, Rosenberg, they realized without a high school, they're going to lose every student. The American kids, David, the American kids are becoming acculturated. And finally, they found a man in Tulsa, Oklahoma, in the oil fields. Rabbi Dr. Bernard Revel pleaded with him, come to New York. And January 1916, they opened Talmudical Academy, which in a few years will celebrate 100 years of fruitful existence. Gentlemen, not only that, Rabbi Revel comes to the yeshiva and he starts to turn it into an American yeshiva. We got to produce rabbis. We have to teach, we have to reach, we have to go all over. And we need ability. And he adds to the rabbinic program now, it becomes a formal program with courses in Jewish history, Jewish philosophy, pedagogy, how to teach, and above all, how to speak. And in 1917, Yeshivat Rabbein Yitzchak Chanan ordains 5 young men. For the first time, 5 young men getting smicha, studying Yoredeya on the east side of New York. Not coming from Europe where they knew everything already. 5 young men, and one of them, Saul B. Friedman, who do you remember, Rabbi Friedman? The first American-born rabbi ordained by Yeshivat Rabbein Yitzchak Elchanan. So you now have a high school, a reorganized yeshiva, but Rabbi Revel is called away. The family is going under financially because of the underhand techniques of the Rockefeller family, a cartel, and pushing the Travis family, which Revel had married into, out of the oil business. And Rabbi Revel lives the yeshiva. And at this moment in time, it's 21, the Beis Medrash Lemorim is ready to close its doors. And the people running the yeshiva, who are very close to Rabbi Berlin, take in the Teachers Institute. When Rabbi Revel comes back in 1922, never to leave the yeshiva again until his death in 1940, he now makes the Teachers Institute an integral part of Yeshiva University. So that when the college opens its doors in 1928, you have as part of what's then called Yeshiva and Yeshiva College, you have REITs, T.I. for men, then known as T.I. because there was no women's T.I., Talmudical Academy, and Yeshiva College. When you come in high school already, you choose for the morning either T.I. or REITs. And the afternoon is high school or college, depending upon where you are in your general education. Out of that format grows the magnificent institution which flourished, and I hope will flourish once again, what you call Yeshiva University. T.I. went through various developments It became the James Dreyer School. It became, today it's called the Mechina. It lost its original purpose, because today chinuch is no longer in the hands of morim. It's basically in the hands of rabbanim. Chinuch has become an art unto itself. Certainly from the right-wing world, where people don't go to college or go to a college simply for the sake of a vocational training, they make a living out of chinuch. And Yeshiva University, its graduates who go into chinuch are the devoted rabbis who understand without chinuch there is no tomorrow, there is no future, there is no youth. And if there is no youth to carry on, God forbid, there is no Torah. So chinuch in the modern world, in the 21st century, has become a sacred calling. But you go back 100 years ago, Rabbi Berlin was revolutionary. T.I., it began, becomes part of yeshiva, never leaving yeshiva, integrated with many different names until today. Essentially today, what separates what was once T.I. from Reitz is simply that what T.I. developed into was for students with minimal background who wanted to become good Jews and learn about Torah. Okay? Now, Rav Meir Berlin coined an epigram, an aphorism, a slogan, call it what you wish, that has become the heart of what Mizrahi is all about. Eretz Yisrael, La'am Yisrael, Al Pi Torah Yisrael. If you haven't heard that aphorism, your education is lacking. I repeat, Eretz Yisrael, La'am Yisrael, Al Pi Torah Yisrael. 1926, he moves back or moves away from New York to Israel, to Jerusalem. He serves as the president of the World Mizrahi. He guides the Mizrahi. He forges institutions for the Mizrahi. And perhaps his greatest contribution that everyone in this room has to be thankful for, as a son of the Netziv, as a son of the illustrious family that built and guided the Lashon Yeshiva, as a leader of Mizrahi, the center of the world, Torah, he was the one who engendered the idea of the Encyclopedia Talmudica. And he came up with this idea that we're living at an age where knowledge is not what it used to be. People can't devote endless years to studying Torah. People need professions, people need university training, people need a new Beit Yosef. What characterizes the Beit Yosef? Rabbi Yosef Karo put together all the sources that were extended his time. When you look into the Beis Yosef, you see all the Gedolei Ashkenaz and all the Gedolei Sfarad, and you have all the endless sources before your fingertips. How do we paskin? How did the Torah reach a decision? Later, the Shulchan Aruch from the Beis Yosef, based upon the Rif, the Rush, the Rambam, he reaches decisions later that becomes the outline of the Shulchan Aruch that so conquers the Torah world until today. We now need a Talmudic encyclopedia. And here, he is blessed that an individual is available who can make it a reality. And this was Rav Shlomo Yosef Zevin. What characterized Rav Zevin? A man of encyclopedic knowledge. A Chabad Chassid from the old school. A Mizrahiite B'lev V'Nefesh. A man, Labriyut, whose breitkeit, whose knowledge is just beyond words. I mean, whoever heard of a Gadol Shebegadolim writing a serious article about Shakespeare's Shylock and analyzing Shylock al pi halacha, how would we deal with it? Who ever heard Rav Zevin wrote about snow? He wrote about topics that the man's grasp of knowledge, world knowledge, was indescribable. His knowledge of Shas and Paiskim, Chassidut, his ability to tell a Hasidic story, his ability to analyze Sfarim, a fountain pen that never stopped moving. What Rav Zevin left us, what a heritage. And he paved the way for the Encyclopedia Talmudic. What's fascinating about the Encyclopedia Talmudic, it revolutionized our method of writing Torah scholarship. The Encyclopedia Talmudic, it's traditional, it's scientific. What do I mean by scientific? It's organized. It's not haphazard. It has footnotes. It has cross references. It uses the technique of the Britannica Encyclopedia. It takes Yafta Lokim Li Yafet V'Yishkon B'Ohel Hashem. Netanel Moshe, they looked around, and Rabbi Huttner, Rav Zevin's assistant, explained this to me. That Rav Zevin looked at encyclopedias and he settled on the format of the Britannica, and they introduced that to the Talmudica. And it's just a world that flows before your eyes at your fingertips. But it's more than that. He revolutionized the method of writing Torah. And in the state of Israel today, the greatest sefer that is used all over the world, Shmirat Shabbat Kehilchata, Rav Nurwitz's method, is the Encyclopedia Talmudica. Compare the two, compare the organization, compare the table of contents, compare the cross-references, compare the footnotes, compare the indices. And all the svarim that have come out subsequently, we have endless svarim on any topic you can imagine, and they all basically follow the format that Rav Zevin introduced. So you see, Rav Meir Berlin left us not only with a Mizrahi movement, which was now on the map. He not only left us with a slogan, a sisma, an aphorism that is so powerful and says it all, but on a practical level, he gave us a great gift. Our only problem is that I've now lived in Israel 42 plus years, and on Simchas Torah, when you're a little bit drunk and you're at Kiddush, you always bless the other person. You should live Chayim Aruchim V'Tovim V'Nizkel V'Reich Al HaMugmar Pshel HaEncyclopedia HaTalmudit. And when you make a bracha like that, it's like telling a person he'll live to 240 years. Nevertheless, what an achievement. What we have so far, indescribable. And I have to tell you, the downside is, I don't know if you want to call it a downside, but everyone today can be a Talmud Chacham. I once heard Shulamit Alon to get up in the Knesset, and she cited sources. I couldn't believe my ears. And you know, she cited them l'nageach, to harm Torah Hashem, but she cited sources one after another. And then it turned out in the newspapers, they were interviewing her, she got all the sources from the Encyclopedia Talmudic. So you see, there's now a plus side and a negative, but all right, I hold the Rav, someone told me a very good story in Seattle. This is a kid, Phil Jacobs, who lived really well. We made this kid from the first time around in Maplewood, New Jersey, in the 1960s. He was a teenage kid, went on to Yeshiva College. And in Yeshiva College, he had a lot of problems, and he was questioning religion. I was already living in Israel, And he went to the Rav, they got an appointment with the Rav, and he told the Rav about his problems. No, you know, the Rav is not a magic maker, what can you do? But he told this young man, with all your problems, continue to study Torah, and you'll see it will turn out okay. And Baruch Hashem, kachav, years later, he continued to study. Chabad picked him up to a certain degree. And I had the greatest nachat to meet him this year in Seattle, like a young man in his 50s today, Shomer Torah and Mitzvah, very inspiring to me. And but the Rav, this is the Rav's approach. As a Litvak, I have to say that even if Shulamit alone, he got all these sources out of the Talmudica, I hope that one day she will get many sources out of the Talmudica, and we will see a Shulamit Aloni with her hair covered with piety and with a mouth that says Birchat HaTorah B'Leiv V'Nefesh every morning. Now, Mizrahi achieved something else. And here we come to something extremely crucial that plays a role on the Israeli scene until this very moment. The United States of America, religion is totally free of any government influence. They attempted to bring a chief rabbi to the United States in 1887. I think you all know the story. The Jews on the east side of New York who cared about Yiddishkeit, now Jews were coming in from Eastern Europe, and it hurt them to see their kids becoming goyim. And they looked at England and, why does England have a traditional element? And they reached the conclusion that England has a chief rabbinate. So they wanted to institute a chief rabbi in the United States. Well, they fought bitter battles, and finally they settled on Rabbi Jacob Joseph from Vilna, brought him to America, 1887. Rabbi Yaakov Yosef was a Talmud Rufaka, Rabbi Yisrael Solanta was a Gaon Adir, who was known as Rabbi Yaakov Harif, had a very sharp mind, was a wonderful speaker, comes to America. Within a few weeks, right up the block, there's another rabbi puts up a sign, Chief Rabbi of the United States. So they asked him, who made you chief rabbi? And he answered, the sign painter. And this is exactly the United States. The government cannot interfere with religion. And before you know it, Rabbi Yaakov Yosef was giving a heksha, so his heksha cost money. They had mashgichim. Another rabbi gave a heksha much cheaper. Housewives didn't care. They bought, which was cheaper. And the story of Rabbi Yaakov Yosef in America is very tragic. It ends in terrible tragedy, and nothing remains of him today except the school that bears his name. Then I don't know if there are any direct descendants who are still Jewish. If there are, please let me know. I'd be very happy to hear about it. But that's America. America does not get involved in religion. It's not England, there's no conservative tradition in America with a small c, there's no royalty in America, there's no chief rabbi, there's no ecclesiastical concept, and you know very well that if a president will start sprouting religion in America, they're going to shoot him down, and you can turn on the air conditioning, Yitzhak, if it's...
I don't know how to do that.
Yeah, Frank, here, turn it on. And this is why in America, with a Christmas tree, right now there was a big problem, gentlemen, there was a big problem with a sukkah Chabad wanted to build on public land in Manhattan, and there was a bit of fight, they went to court, now they reached a compromise, someone gave them private land to build on, but I'll tell you, this is America. Palestine was very different. Under the Turkish rule, the ecclesiastic authorities had the sole say in personal law, so that divorce and marriage, conversion, if you were Mohammedan, you went to the imams. If you were Protestant, you went to the pastor. If you were Catholic, you went to the priest. If you were a rabbi, you went, if you were a Jew, you went to the rabbi. Which rabbi did you go to? the Turkish only recognized the Sfadik rabbi of Jerusalem, Rabbi Yaakov Meir, who was called the Chacham Bashi. Chacham Bashi, as David Pardo will tell you, in Turkish is chief rabbi. Chacham Bashi. Chacham Harosh. Now, this Palestine was developing a very large Baruch Hashem Jewish community. There were 10,000, 20,000, 30,000. It was too much for one rabbi. In addition, you had Ashkenazic Jews. And Ashkenazic Jews felt awkward going to a rav who was Sfadik, a Dat HaMizrach, with different traditions, different concepts, different rulings, different psakim. 1921, the Jewish High Commissioner of Palestine, he was British and he was Jewish, Sir Herbert Samuel, very interesting individual, close to Rav Kook, close to Rav Zonnenfeld, an individual who was honored with the Haftorah, and people felt it was like an Atchalta de Geula, that you had a Jewish High Commissioner right after the Balfour Declaration. Sir Herbert Samuel called a conference in the Chorva Synagogue, which has just been rebuilt, and that conference lasted for 3 days. All the heads of the Jewish community were there. And the end result was the formation of the chief rabbinate of the state of Israel. That chief rabbinate, which functions in Palestine, then the state of Israel, has ecclesiastical power. It is recognized by the government. It is empowered by the government. During the period before the state, when the British ran the country, they empowered the chief rabbinate. The Knesset empowered the chief rabbinate. And we have a chief rabbinate that functions until this very minute, plays a role in each and every life here. Now, what do I mean plays a role? What are we talking about? First of all, you want to get married. In order to get married, you have to go to the local religious council. All this functions under the chief rabbinate. There are various takonet that the chief rabbinate introduced that obligate every Jew in the country, for the sake of argument. You go into Beis Din with a monetary dispute. In other words, when it comes to a monetary dispute, you have a choice. You can go to Beis Din, or you can go to a general court. You go into a Beis Din. Women are allowed to testify. This was one of the first takanot of the chief rabbinate. I believe it goes back to 1945, that lebura hadava, it's not kiyum hadava, it's not edut at a wedding or a Beit Din at a gerut, but women are allowed to testify. No one can go into a Beis Din, and you know, I've seen in my life machloket where a man will say, "No nisht afrais, he's nisht nevi afrais. I don't want a woman. Who's a woman?" You know, that attitude in a Beis Din in Israel, it can't happen. That once happened, by the way, you should know, in the Bronx. Abba Brandspiegel, should live and be well. Rabbi Brandspiegel had an older brother. I believe it was Abe Brandspiegel. Abe Brandspiegel changed his name to Brown. He was a photographer, Holocaust survivor, he died young. So one time he had a fight with a woman, a bar mitzvah, over Nebuch Bronx people, over pennies. And he shouted at her, "Who are you to argue with me? You're no more than a lowly woman," as if to say. She took him to Din Torah before Rav Moshe Bick. And if my memory is correct, he was fined by Rav Moshe Bick $25. That was an astronomical sum for embarrassing a lady. So you see, this is a takana of the chief rabbinate. For the sake of argument, Matan walks in to the chief rabbinate, and he has two girls on his He wants to marry two Svadiyot. He says, I can't make a choice. They're both wonderful women. They both agree. They both want to be my wives. And he brings down all the sources that since he lives in Eretz Yisrael, he has to follow Moran, the Beit Yosef, right? The Moradiyara, the Eretz Yisrael. And since he lives in Eretz Yisrael, and these are women of Moroccan origins, and their grandparents had three wives and four wives, etc., etc., why can't he? And he's right, halachically, Matan is absolutely right. But the Chief Rabbinate will show him that there's a cherem of the Chief Rabbinate. They extended in 1950, they extended the cherem of the Rabbeinu Geshem, and they extended it to all the Eidot, and marrying two wives is bigamy, even though halachically it's permissible, but in Eretz Yisrael it is forbidden by the Chief Rabbinate, you see? But I'll give you another example. I just had a case, some of you know that I was very happy because I mentioned to a student a nasty divorce. There are many divorces going on now that I know about, unfortunately. It really hurts me. One of them is a Kollel graduate. It's beyond words. But anyway, this is a student of mine, and he was married many years, and it exploded. And he's, you know, I don't know where justice is, her side, his side, it could be both sides. But he was very bitter, and after the court reached a decision and they had a financial arrangement, he asked to give a get. And he started already, she did this and that, and he didn't want to give a get. All right, thank God he listened to me, and before Rosh Hashanah he gave a get, and I want to compliment him and thank him. He makes me very proud. And you understand, when you don't give a get, even if there's, you're right, and your wife wronged you. Let's take the worst scenario, but it's a chilul Hashem, because you give the enemies of Torah ammunition that once again a man is making a woman an aguna. And I'm very pleased. And I'll tell you what advice, if you're going to be in the rabbinate, I'll tell you advice that I gave him. I hope he listens. I said to him that at this point now you gave a get, there are children involved. If anyone asks you about your wife, ex-wife, just say she was wonderful, she was good. Whatever problems there were, ask her. Don't say a bad word now. You have to go further. Get along with the children. Take my word for it, I know what I'm talking about. I don't have time to elaborate, but I can give you many examples from my life experience. If it didn't work out, it didn't work out. It exploded. But end the animosity, because no one wins when you badmouth each other. So now let's come to the state of Israel. My daughter unfortunately has to deal with this day in and day out. And I know a lot about the laws through her, and she was involved basically. I'll explain to you in a second the law that was changed here. A guy doesn't want to give a get. Right? He says like he'll tell the judges, she did this to me, she did that to me, she looked at this man, she sinned, she this, that. He's absolutely right. But the Dayanim say, there's no chance to save this marriage. You have to give a get. You have to end the argument. God forbid she'll live in sin, you'll live in sin, children involved. You must give a get. And he refuses. Okay? If he refuses, they apply sanctions to him. Now, these sanctions are not, the rabbinate is applying them. But the law of the land, because there's a chief rabbinate, because they're empowered by the law of the land, the sanctions are legally binding. He can't have a driver's license. He can't have a checking account. He can't have a passport, etc., etc. He can't have a visa. They take away all his privileges. If he's a doctor, he can't renew his license. A lawyer can't renew his license to practice, etc. What if this doesn't help? And he says, the hell with you. I'll go around collecting alms at the Kotel. I don't care. So they can throw him into jail. No, throw a guy into jail, he gives a get mighty quickly. So there were two cases that came up. My daughter was involved in one of the cases. Two cases that came up where people were in jail. No, Michael, if you're in jail, do you give a hoot if they're going to throw you into jail? You're in jail anyway. Both of them were in jail. One of them was in jail for armed robbery, a pretty serious crime, many years. So the Knesset passed the law that the rabbis have a right, this was epic making. It never was before that the Dayanim can put a prisoner into solitary confinement. In other words, until now, only the Shabbos, the Sheirut Bitachon Soha, Sheirut Bitachon Shabbos, it's called. I hope I'm right. Sheirut Batei HaSoha. Thank you. Okay? Only the Shabbos could put a prisoner into solitary. Rabbis, now in these two cases, both men gave a get. One gave at the end of the day, one at the day and a half. Both of them gave a get. I can tell you better. You see, the law of the land, this is so important. My daughter had a case where this case was sent to her. You should know, on this level, the Batei Dinim of the Eid HaRei did cooperate with the Batei Dinim of the Rabbanut. And sometimes they will refer cases to Anim Rabbaniim who will appear before Batei Dinim Rabbani of this state because they feel it can be handled better. So there was a case with a woman, they referred the case to my daughter, that my daughter should become her Tohenet and it should be handled by the Rabbanit. And this woman was a Haredit woman from the Geula area, and her husband was a successful businessman. But he had wandering eyes and paramours in a number of ports. And he refused to give a get because he didn't want to give a settlement. A settlement means he has to give up a good deal of his money. So my daughter gets a tzav matzah connect, or a warrant for his arrest. The problem is he's not in the country, he's in England. So my daughter gets a call. I mean, she's always said she wishes she could have videoed this to show her children. She gets a call about 9 o'clock at night that the man is, I don't want to use vulgar language, but he's with a woman in a little hotel in the Geula section. My daughter calls the police. Police car comes 5 minutes later. There's a driver in it and another guy with him, two policemen, and my daughter's sitting in the back. And the guy sitting next to the driver can't understand what's going on. They're going to Geula to arrest the Chassidish Jew. He's here from France. And the driver says, Al tadak, hayiti kvar b'seret hazeh. I already was in this scenario. I was already in this movie. He says, the Tohenet knows what she's doing. And sure enough, they got the guy, took him to jail. The next morning, he's in court. And boy, did he give a get quickly. But my daughter says he was a gentleman, you see? After the get, he went over to my daughter and he sort of bowed to her and said, Kol HaKavod. He admitted that they caught him. That's it, he was a gentleman, that's it. He had some France of paramour and Geula of paramour. God have mercy what men are capable of. I'm not a fan of the male species, I have to tell you that, what I have seen in life. But you see, the rabbinate here has power. This is the difference. Now, the chief rabbinate, I don't have to tell you, originally the people elected were Gedolei Gedolei Yisrael. I need only mention the first Ashkenazic chief rabbi was the legendary Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Cook. He was chief rabbi at first with Rabbi Yaakov Meir, the Chacham Bashi. Rabbi Yaakov Meir died, he was succeeded by the legendary Rabbi Tzion Chai Uziel. As some of you may know, Rabbi Uziel's grandsons, one of them, Meir Weingarten, is a great grandson, I believe. I may be skipping a generation, it could be he's a grandson. But anyone know Meir Weingarten? He went to Machon Lev, he works for the OU today in America, has a big range, has big travel groups to Israel, his father's business. So that's Rabbi Uziel. Rav Cook was succeeded, of course, by Rav Yitzchak Isaac Halevi Herzog, whom I've spoken about so many times. I'll tell you one anecdote about him that I absolutely know to be true, and boy, you have to appreciate this one, and I hope you'll never quote it in the rabbinate. Those of you going into the rabbinate, or those of you living in the rabbinate, I hope you never have to quote this, but in the early 50s, I've heard Sartre visited America, maybe 49. Now, you have to look at my book on the Blaise de Silva. I think I mentioned his visit there. It was his second visit to the United States. And you don't know what went on. Rav Herzog was in the Bronx for Shabbos in the Beis Medrash HaGadol. I don't know whether the rabbi met. There were two Beis Medrash HaGadols, one Ashkenaz, one Sfadi, around the corner from each other. What Tova Lichtenstein, what Dr. Tova Lichtenstein spoke about at the book launch, and what she quotes from my book. And he was at the Beis, I don't know which one it was, but the whole Bronx was talking. Rav Herzog is here. I live further up, so I wasn't there. But everyone was talking Shabbos, the Bronx. So there's a fellow who works for Torah Tshraga, Kapinski, Dov Kapinski, I think his name is. Anyway, his great uncle was davening, and his uncle, these were the few Shomer Shabbos families in the Bronx. And his great uncle goes over to Rav Herzog on Shabbos, and he says, all in Yiddish, but I'll say it in English, Rebbe, I have a difficult question to ask. And he asked Chief Rabbi Herzog, we say in Tehillim, "Amati b'chavzi kol adam kozev," that every man is deceitful. And he asked the Chief Rabbi, "Rebbe, does meint rabbanim eichet? Does that mean rabbis also are deceitful?" And Rav Herzog went in the rabbi there and knew the ball score. Without batting an eyelash, he says to him, "Nein, ois kumin, to get along with a balabas, with a layman like you are, the rabbi has to be a malach." It says, "Kol adam kozev." It doesn't say angels are deceitful. To get along with a tramp like you and oisvach like you, the rav dasein a malach. You follow me, Moshe? That was unbelievable. And Elia, his name was Baruch Kapinski. Elia was the grandfather of this boy. This was his great uncle. He was so happy that Rav Herzog smacked his face. He was telling everyone when he asked the Chief Rabbi, when the Chief Rabbi answered him. Within a week, every Jew in the Bronx that had a slight connection to Torah knew this story. Rav Herzog was succeeded from this point on. I know all the chief rabbis personally by Rav Issa Yehuda Unterman. And you got to understand who Rav Unterman was. This was a prince of an individual, had been rabbi in Liverpool, a Europäische Talmud Chacham. What a fabulous individual. He was the third chief rabbi. He rabbinated with Rav Yitzchak Nissim. Rav Yitzchak Nissim had wealth. He came from a wealthy Baghdad family. I believe they were copy dealers, so you got to check it out. You can correct me if I'm wrong. And he was Kulo Emet. And he, one second here, and he fought bitterly with the young Rav Ovadia Yosef. Do you know why? No, why? Because Rav Ovadia, Rav Yitzchak Nissim, you followed the Ben Ish Chai, and Rav Ovadia Yosef was turning back the clock to the Beis Joseph. And when the Ben Ish Chai, Rav Yosef Chaim Baghdadi, disagreed with the Beis Yosef, to Rav Nissim, the Ben Ish Chai was Kadosh Kadoshim. And to Rav Ovadia, he was turning back the clock. And he viewed him as a chutzpah. How does a young man fight the Ben Ish Chai? And of course, they were succeeded by the chief rabbis, Rabbi Shlomo Gorin and Rabbi Ovadia Yosef. And that was a very volatile chief rabbinate. Rav Gorin was coming from the army, and the famous Langer case. And Rav Gorin was used to banging on the table. He was a major. I once spoke with him about what titles to use in the Encyclopedia Judaica when I quoted him in an article I wrote in Disinterment. And I had all the titles there. Major General, Rabbi, understand you can't leave anything out. And Rav Ovadia Yosef did something that no one could believe was possible. Until Rav Ovadia Yosef, all the Sephardic chief rabbis curtsied before the Ashkenazim. The Ashkenazim ruled Minig Ashkenaz. They're the majority. They're the power. They're the Zionists. They're the Jewish agency. They control the agency. They control the Knesset. The Svadim had an inferiority complex. And along comes Rabbi Ovadia Yosef and says, "You Ashkenazim, get the heck out of here. Your psak has no role to play here. This is the home of the Beis Yosef." Moshe, he wrapped them on the knuckles and told them, "You have to follow the Beis Yosef." And you know, the famous Chubit of Rabbi Ovadia, marriage during the 3 weeks. Danny, did you get married during the 3 weeks? The last thing, Wolf, you have to be Ashkenazi, chas v'chalilah. But David, can you get married during the 3 weeks? Absolutely. It's just, what are you, 9 days? No, which is it? 1 year, every other year, you have nothing whatsoever. Tisha B'Av is Chal on Sunday. Where's Shavuot Shechal Bo Tisha B'Av? Oh my gosh, David, David, you are so lucky. What yiches, what yiches, what yiches. He speaks Turkish and Yiddish. His mother is Munkach and his father is Turkish. No, and Rabbi Vajra, when he became chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, wrote a tshuva, "I called the Ashkenazim off. How dare you not allow the Sfadim? I gave an order. Any Sfadi can be married during the 3 weeks. Only the 9 days will be machmir. But until then," and Rabbi Ovadia stood up. Wow. And then, of course, you come to the modern chief rabbis who represented the religious Zionist community at its best, Rabbi Avram Shapiro, Reb Mordechai ben Eliyahu, Gedolim, Gedole Yisrael, people I knew personally. Rabbi Avram Shapiro offered me a position. I should come and work with them and be a liaison to the great Anglo-Torah world. But once again, Moshe, I knew that the only place I belong is behind my desk teaching. So I had to apologize and explain. He once asked me, by the way, why I don't have a beard. And before I could even answer, he said, "Your wife doesn't want you to." And he meant it seriously. But if you read my book, you'll understand why I don't have a beard. It basically has nothing to do with my wife. If she had my her way, I would have a beard. But Baruch Hashem. Okay, let me just go one step further. Then, of course, we come to the two chief rabbis who preceded the present pair, Reb Yisrael Meir Lau and Reb Eliyahu Bakshi Daron. Rav Bakshi Daron, I taught with his brother in Michlala. We're already talking about a product of Eretz Yisrael, a product of the religious Zionist movement here. Rav Yisrael may allow, of course, no one has more charisma than Rabbi Lau. I have to tell you, his life story is beyond words. It's worthy of a movie, Al Tishlach Yadcha El Hanar. The story is beyond words. He comes, he was part of everything here. He was raised by an uncle and aunt of Rabbanim. He had no family left. It was his father's sister, I believe. Great Mizrahi leaders. He was exposed to Bnei Akiva. He can give you the starting lineup for every English soccer team out of the 1960s. I mean, that's a sign he was integrated. He had a youth, etc. He goes to... he's a graduate, I believe, of Panovich. You can correct me if I'm wrong. He was exposed. He went to he studied with the yeshiva in Kol Torah. He studied in Kol Torah. He's a total product of the Israeli scene. But more than that, he is a fabulous speaker. He knows the audience. He knows the element here. He knows how to speak to them. He knows how to relate to them. But by now, the chief rabbinate is caught up in tremendous political upheaval and turmoil. And here's something I said last week, very briefly. We'll come to it after Sukkot again. Nothing succeeded like the Mizrahi movement. It succeeded so that it wiped itself off the map. Meaning, on one hand, take my grandchildren, born and raised here. They see no need. What do you mean, Mizrahi? Who needs Mizrahi? We're all Mizrahi. Kippah are all over the place. Women with their hair covered are all over the place. We've become part and parcel of the total Israeli scene. This did not exist before. Moshe Mandelbaum, when he rose very high in the Israeli government, my neighbor, never wore a kippah at work. I asked him why. He said he wanted to get ahead. If a mappinik saw you wearing a kippah, you couldn't go further. Went to work with a hat. He was the mankal of the Shmarat HaSiyah. He was the head of the Bank of Israel. By the time he was head of the Bank of Israel, he wore a kippah already. Today, wearing a kippah many times is an advantage, not a disadvantage. They say about certain elite units in the army, if you're not wearing a kippah, you can't get in. All right, the left says that. They're complaining, they're butchering, they're criticizing. But the fact that they can say it shows you where we're at. Whoever saw TV commentators, one after another, would keep up. Women reporting, mainline TV, tichels. So who needs Mizrahi? But more than that, the whole so-called Haredi world lives in Mizrahi existence. They're integrated on the Israeli scene. Everyone wants part of the pie. Everyone wants the Knesset. Everyone wants government funds. No one is standing on the side. The Turekata is batel b'shishim. Eidah Charedit batel b'shishim. Rav Chaim Yosef Zonnefeld, I always say there were two antagonists. You all know Rav Chaim Yosef Zonnefeld had nothing to do with the chief rabbinate. How can you have a government-controlled chief rabbinate where the government intervenes, where the government interferes? Rav Kook, of course, was the big pro-chief rabbinate. No, you look at Rav Zonnefeld and Rav Kook, look at their heritage 80 years later. There are very few people alive that are descendants of Rav Kook. But come on, all who bear the name Kook are in the Haredi or the semi-Haredi world. And Rav Chaim Yosef Zonnefeld has hundreds and hundreds of descendants with kippahs through God who have served in the army, among them Chief Rabbi Metzger, who was a paratrooper, is married to Rav Chaim Zonnefeld's great-granddaughter, etc., etc. Raketa student from Michlala. It's amazing what's happened here. Total integration on the level which they believe, but everyone's part of the state. And the politics, of course, with the chief rabbinate, has become monumental. And in the last election, two candidates were elected who were a result of the so-called Haredi world, which is total contradiction. What are you doing with the chief rabbinate? It's Zionism, it's Mizrahi, it's what you don't believe in. What you don't believe in? Big question mark today. Part and parcel. And that, of course, is the election of Rav Yonah Metzger, which was a result of Rav Yashiv's support, and the election of Rav Shlomo Amar, which was the trade-off with the Shas people, and that's the present chief rabbinate. So you see, the chief rabbinate has come a long way. It's beyond description. Who would ever dream back in 1921 that the day would come when the so-called successor to Rav Chaim Yosef Zonnefeld, spiritual successor, would be determining who would become the chief rabbi of the state of Israel. It is food for thought. There is an entire process at work here. And Moshe, we haven't heard the last word yet. Take my word for it. We're still caught up with it. We are living it. We are living it right now. To reiterate, what did we do today? Nathaniel, we came into Mizrahi. What's bothering you, Yitz? I see you're shaking your head.
You left Rabbi Meir, but it just went off.
Well, Rabbi Meir, The mayor of Berlin is...
He's taking it somewhere.
No, that's from Mayor Berlin. These are his achievements.
He died?
I gave
him his name. What did he do? After he came to Palestine?
Just what I told you. He's a publicist, the writer, a propagandist, the speaker.
He didn't exactly. Found that he achieved us. He didn't do
no, anything. His greatest achievement... His greatest achievement was the Encyclopedia Talmudic. This was his dream. And he brought it to fruition right after World War II. He already was working on it. He was talking about it already in the 30s. But this was, he was a politician. He was president of the Mizrahi. But his name was Berlin. And this, of course, was America Teachers Institute, Eretz Yisrael, Am Yisrael, Al-Pi Torah Yisrael. But World War I, the impetus, the push, the catalyst of Jewish suffering, this is what put Zionism on the map.
Did he do any Piskei Halacha?
No, please.
He
wasn't a Gadol Hadar. Why do you force me to say it? You understood from my words.
No, I didn't understand.
He was the young son of Rebbe. He barely knew his father, the Netziv. You want to know what he did? He wrote a memoir. He didn't write from Washington Avenue to Washington Street, but he gave me the idea. From Volozhin Biz Yerushalayim, wrote a memoir. I think he wrote it originally in Yiddish, if I'm not mistaken.
Now, what was his connection with the Soloveitchiks?
The connection with the Soloveitchiks, it was a minor connection, not a major connection. But he was involved, if I'm not mistaken, look into a footnote I have in the Rav, he was involved in pushing Rav Amiel. He felt that Rav Amiel was more matim than his cousin for the chief rabbinate of Tel Aviv in 1945. In matter of fact, I think attributed to him is the statement that as follows. There were 35. There were attributed to him is the statement. Rav Amiel was running. The Rav was running. Who was the third candidate? Let me just think. Rav Aronson had just died. There was a third candidate. You have to see my footnote. Someone challenged me who the third candidate was. It could be it was the Punovitcher Rav. Rav Kahaneman. But anyway, a statement is attributed to Rav Meir Berlin that my cousin was the biggest Lamdan. The other candidate was the biggest Tzaddik. But Rav Amiel is given Pasik. He was the one that Hidimlo. He was the one that Hidimlo Tel Aviv Bishar Zot. In other words, at that moment in time, Rav Amiel was well known. He came from Belgium, he had a following, he was in his prime, he was a fabulous speaker, he knew modern Hebrew, so he was the candidate. I believe that statement is attributed to Rav Meir Berlin. Take a look into it. I have a footnote in the Rav on it. So that's Rav Berlin. But once the Mizrahi is running, you got to understand what happens, and that's Palestine, and that's the British, and that's the chief rabbinate. And the chief rabbinate is an unbelievable story that continues until this day. Achievement, but struggle. Achievement, but tension. And we live with it. It's part of our very existence at this moment. I just want to say a few words about this book. As you know, occasionally I've reviewed books, and this is an Arts Row book, and I have to say it is very fair. What's fascinating about the volume is Rav Gifta owes his Yiddishkeit to Talmudical Academy. And his Rebbe in Talmudical Academy was Rav Aaron Moshe Peleyev. And this comes across very nicely in the volume. You also see his total dedication to teaching Torah, and he began late in life. He comes to Talmudical Academy with basically knowing a daf or two of Gemara. That's all he had studied where he grew up. And he literally comes yesh mayayin, and then his uncle, and here, the book should have given more detail in Rav Shmuel Zahar. It mentions the fact that his uncle sent him to Telz in Europe, but who the uncle was, I mean, that's lacking. A little research should have been done on Rav Shmuel Leib. If they only had interviewed me, I could have given them a little bit insight. I knew Dean Zahar very, he was Dean of Men at the Yeshiva. Under Rabbi Revel, he was the right hand of Rabbi Revel. Under Dr. Belkin, Dean Zahar once said to me, the more titles they give me, the more honor they give me, the less influence I have. And it's a very sharp, insightful word. What's amazing about Dean Zahar is that 1962, the year after I got smicha, there was another smicha class, and that celebration was held in the Beis Medrash. And Dean Zahar was the first speaker, introduced the event. He was the elder statesman, and right after he finished speaking, right after, in the Beis Medrash, he keeled over, had a heart attack, and died in the Beis Medrash of the Yeshiva. I mean, these are unbelievable details. I know more details he told me when he was in, when the Telz Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Gordon, visited London in, it was during World War I, I believe, visited London, or it was right after World War I, or right before World War I, you have to check out the exact date. So he already was in London, he had finished Telz, he was in London, and the Telz Rosh Yeshiva died in London while he was visiting. And they asked the young Shmuel Leib Zahar, he's buried in London, Yehuda Leib Bloch, I believe his name, Rabbi Yehuda Leib, or was it Rabbi Leib Bloch, or that was the son, anyway, Rabbi Yehuda Leib, I believe it was. Anyway, so the Telz Rosh Yeshiva died, and they asked the young Shmuel Leib Zahar to eulogize him. And he told me, he got up in front of the audience, and his legs were shaking. He was so nervous eulogizing his Rebbe in front of this tremendous audience. What's fascinating in this book is on page 211, tells the story of a kid coming to Telz, and this kid tells the story that Gifter interviewed him, and this was about Tshuva coming from Israel. He's looking for yeshiva, and I explained to him that I felt that Lithuanian Jews were not as loving and spiritual as Hasidim. I had contact with Hasidim in my recent past, and these were my feelings. When he heard that, Rav Gifter was momentarily taken aback. Then he said, I can assure you that yeshivish Jews are very loving. He paused for a moment and then asked me, do you want to see angels? I hadn't really thought about it before, but it sounded like a good idea, so I said, yes, I would like to see angels. Rav Gifter said, stay here and you will see angels. Rav Gifter arranged for the best bachurim in the yeshiva to be Aryeh's learning partners, and instructed them to stay away from all other conversations, even Hashkafa, and just learn Torah with Aryeh. No learning, only learning. A few days later, Aryeh says, I called my friends in Boston and asked them to pack up all my things and send them. I totally loved it in Telz, angels or not. Nearly 40 years later, Rabbi Aryeh Burnham lives in Eretz Yisrael, where he disseminates Torah. Does anyone know him? It's a very interesting comment. And by the way, I think he's absolutely right that a kid today needs some chassidus. There's some warmth in it. The Litvish Welt that I grew up in is lacking today. It doesn't convey this. Rav Gifter got away with it. He showed him angels. Okay. Maybe we have angels here in the Kollel, I don't know, but it's a very interesting book. Now, I'll come back to this book again when I get to Das Torah, because I have something very sharp to say about some of, I mean, not of critical, the book is giving facts, but it leads me to a very interesting question vis-a-vis Das Torah. Hold on one second. I just have a few freebies. If anyone wants to see the challenge to Chovevei Torah and our graduate from this kollel, Rabbi Yosef Kanevsky. This is a Xerox of Rabbi Yitzchak Adlerstein's article, which appeared in Ami, and this is the article that appeared in Yetei Ne'eman. Both are very interesting articles, and a challenge YU, RCA, OU, to declare them chutz l'tchum. So I guess with me they don't have a problem because I already opened my mouth. Yeah. Oh, Rav Herzog was the third candidate. That's what I have. Did you look in my book?
Why?
No. So you know why I was hesitant, because I was corrected by people in B'nai Brak who have a document which shows that the Punovich Rav was a candidate too. So I don't know how true that is, the Rav Herzog. But then 2 years later, he was elected chief rabbi of Israel. But I have to look in my book. I have to refurbish my memory. But my memory is shattered here because I was corrected. I was shot at. And the family would not make the document available to me because I don't believe. I want to see it with my own eyes. Because it has to deal with the Rav making a mistake in his own biography. You know what I'm talking about? When the Rav showed us the letter from the Achiezer, from Chaim Moshe Grzynski, and it says, you should support this candidate, but I'm afraid he won't be elected because he's not an open Mizrahiite. And in the three dots there, the Rav said, fill in my name, Harav Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik, did that, right? And it turns out, according to B'nai Brak, it's not the Rav, it's the Rav Kahaneman in that letter. So I don't know, the Rav made a mistake. Now, this is unbelievable, that Manuvel Gafni, Mark Gafni, Mark Winyaz, whatever name you know him by, Mordechai Gafni, he has surfaced again. And the Gary Rosenblatt has a whole article. He's now an undenominational spiritual leader. He's out in San Francisco. You can do whatever you want there. And once again, the women are making charges against him. I am flabbergasted, and I once again demand an apology from Rabbi Saul Berman. I just bothers me. So you know the story that I called Gafni a manuvel. So Saul Berman said, well, Rabbi Kepler is angry at him because he's no longer Orthodox. No longer Orthodox. I don't give a hoot what he is. But when you rape and seduce women, that I know lives have been destroyed, and here he now surfaces again. This is the article on the Erev. With all the comment, it's unbelievable the enmity that liberal Jews have towards Torah Hashem Tamima, the Erev in Manhattan that went down and all the problems in recycling it. And this is a very special article for a baseball connoisseur. It's from the New York Times on Ted Williams 406. And even though Yitzchak comes from Boston, he can't appreciate it.
Michael
will appreciate it. Finally, if anyone wants a copy of the 1956 Psak Din, I made copies of it, and you have the 11 signatures of the Rosh Yeshiva, and look, YU is represented more than anyone, Rav Menachem Yosef Zaks and Harav David Lipschitz. It equals Teira Vadas that has Rav Kamenetsky and Rav Shah. My dear students, you should have an easy fast, a fabulous Yom Kippur, a wonderful Chag. We pick up again the Monday morning after Sukkot. I check with the authorities. Gris Kollel begins again. Until we meet again in health and happiness. Das v'danya.